reflective music, deep music. I've got a message for us today, and the message for us today is the power of empathy. And I emphasize the aspect of power of empathy because I've already run into a challenge with some people in the room. The nice people hear the word empathy and they're like, oh good, finally somebody's gonna speak on empathy because we could use a lot more of it these days. Others of you hear the word empathy and maybe you have a response that I received on social media recently when attempting to be empathetic, I got the response snowflake, that I was delicate and that I was too caring and that I was too sensitive and whatever else. So I want to emphasize it's not the power of empathy, it's the power of empathy that we want to talk about today. So first, let me just give a little differentiation between sympathy and empathy. There's different ways you can do this. Let's look at this one. Two definitions for you. Sympathy means you care. Empathy means you share, right? So right now, sympathy may be something that Dallas Cowboy fans are doing towards Houston Texan fans right now. They're not identifying with the struggles they've had in the past. They're just saying, wow, that must be hard being you right now, right? I wouldn't know. I lived internationally for a long time, and one of my struggles is coming back to the United States after living in a variety of different countries in Asia and in Europe primarily. I'm often assumed to be just a regular Texas guy. And although I grew up in Texas, my world and my views have changed. And so even making a American football provincial sports joke is quite an accomplishment of mine. I feel pretty good about that. And I hope it's been powerful and useful. But empathy means that you actually share. Specifically, it means that you share the perspective of somebody else, that you've turned around and you can see from their perspective. Atticus Finch talking about being in someone else's skin, standing in someone else's shoes, and looking at reality from their perspective. And this is really important in business, in life, and relationships. The failure to do empathy well means you lose a lot of opportunities. Let's look at one of the problems of having low empathy in competition. All right? Well, there we go. Empathy shares the perspective of the other, including their thoughts and feelings. Let's see what happens. All right, if you're playing hide and seek and you have low empathy, this is you. You see that? The failure to see from the perspective of the one who's competing against you means that you can't see them, and so you think you're safe. And you can't understand why your ideas, why your objectives, why your plans aren't being successful. And you're frustrated, and you're just too low empathy is really the problem. What happens if you have high empathy? Here's high empathy. These are the same two pictures. This is a sniper. The sniper empathetically understands what it looks like to have his competition looking across the horizon and saying, where's the threat? Where's my challenge? Who do I need to come against? And so you see the sniper in the trees over there and you think he's not really there. That's just an empty picture. He's tricking me. That's what speakers do sometimes. But then you have it outlined, and if you get close and you look at it, you realize he's right there. And not is he right there, he's pointing his weapon at you and he's ready to deliver his ammunition. He has high empathy. So what I want us to understand is that being empathetic is not a sign of weakness. It's not a concession of your convictions. It's not a moving away from where you've rooted yourself. It's the kind of mobility that allows you to take what you value, that you want to be able to send forward, hopefully not bullets, hopefully something more constructive and useful, and doing it in a way that is actually intelligent, informed, and effective. So let's look at how Paul does this as we go forward. All right, here's what we're going to be looking for. The main point, empathy is more than being nice. Empathy helps get things done. Empathy is something that's very powerful and effective. Let's look at Paul in Acts 17, verses 16 through 34. Now, as I set this up, Acts 14, Paul shows up in a foreign country, got a foreign language, and he has this miraculous healing. After the healing occurs, everyone is excited, and he thinks, here's a great opportunity for me to get my message across. And he begins to share the gospel. But what ends up happening is the people begin to think, here's Hermes and Zeus, and they get their priest and they bring out there and they want to sacrifice an oxen to the gods. And he says, no, no, no. And he tries to get his message across, but it's too late. He's lost the empathetic connection. And as a result, even a great work of God gets misinterpreted by others that are listening. Go ahead to the next slide, if you would, please. In Acts 17, verses 16 through 21, what we're going to see is being proactive. It's actually going to create opportunities for us. So beginning in verse 16 of Acts 17, Paul was waiting for the rest of his team in Athens. He was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. How did he know? He's paying attention. He's walking. He's being aware. So he reasoned in the synagogue both with Jews and God-fearing Greeks, people who were already more or less close to his opinion, the so-called echo chamber, people that more or less held the basic premises that he had. But he was saying, I understand your basic position, but there's a more specific position I'd like you to understand, namely that the Messiah is Jesus. But then when he goes out from the synagogue, he's got another challenge. He's in the marketplace, day by day, with those who happen to be there. So there's a group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers, and these are philosophers who are diametrically opposed arguments. They're both pagans, they're both idolaters, but they take totally different positions on how to explain life and its meaning. And Paul begins to interact with them, and his challenge is higher. So some of them, they ask Paul, what is this babbler trying to say? And others said, he seems to be advocating foreign gods. They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Then they took him and brought him to a meeting at the Areopagus, where they said to him, may we know what this new teaching is that you're presenting. You're bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we'd like to know what they mean. See, because all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. So do you see how Paul is able, through proactive empathy, paying attention to what's going around and engaging people in a whole range of different ideas, feelings, and thoughts. And in doing so, he runs into some initial obstacles, but because he's proactively listening, he's going to get an opportunity. The opportunity here is, we'd really like to hear what you have to say. I got that opportunity one time at a funeral in remote China where I was hiking. I was a foreign exchange student, doing graduate research on the China-Burma border. It was also something I was doing with my Christian mission in terms of reaching an unreached people group, a predominantly Buddhist tribe that had no believers among themselves. No other nearby Christian groups were reaching out to them. And when they did claim to have reached out to them, they said, these people are really hard. They won't listen to us. They don't want to hear our message. So I spent my time learning their language, learning their customs, their cultures, I couldn't fit in. I obviously looked different, but I tried to connect. So I'm on this hike, and I come through this really remote place, and they're stunned to see this foreigner. They get excited, and they invite me in. And it looks like a big festival, and it looks like it's going to be fun. So I ask them, what's going on? They go, oh, it's a funeral. I'm like, oh, I don't want to interrupt you. I'll go. They go, no. Our funerals take 3 days. It's a really old guy. We knew he was going to die anyway. We have lots of funerals, and we're in the second of 3 days, so I'm kind of bored. Come on in. I'm like, well, you all have foreigners here very often. They say, oh, yeah, we had some back here a while ago. They were flying planes. I'm like, who? And I realized it was the Flying Tigers right before World War II. It was the last time that they had had Westerners in this village. So I'm thinking, this is not Paul in the synagogue. This is Paul in a very foreign place with very different ideas. How am I going to come across without being a babbler? How am I going to empathetically connect? What would you do? Think of the situation that you may be in your own relationships, at work, in other places, and you've got this real struggle of trying to figure out how do I go forward. The answer is first connect and then correct. So what I did is I began to ask them questions. I essentially turned into a four-year-old. I said, what's this? What's that? How does that work? Why do you do this? Do you do that all the time? Who else does that? And I asked questions about everything that was inside the Buddhist temple and about the leaders of that Buddhist temple and about their community and about what they were experiencing and what it was like to go through this funeral and what happens afterwards. And after a while, they got tired of my questions and they decided, well, we can do this too. What do you think? What do you think is the meaning of life? What do you do when you face death? if you don't do this, what do you do? In other words, they said, why don't you step up and explain to us? And like I'm standing here in front of you today, I was ushered up with a giant Buddha image sitting behind me and all the rest of the stuff around me and all the Buddhist elders sitting in front of me eagerly listening to what I had to say. It was a wonderful opportunity. And it wasn't an original thing with me. Again, it comes from what I've learned from studying the scriptures and studying life. In verse 22, Paul stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and he said, people of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God. So, that which you are ignorant of is the very that you worship, and what it is, I'm going to explain to you. You see, the God who made the world and everything in it, the Lord of heaven and earth, he doesn't live in temples built by human hands, and he's not served by human hands as if he needed anything. Rather, he himself gives life and breath and everything else. Any ladies in here, and I hope that's not too gender inappropriate, but any ladies in here go to do your nails at a place where there's different idols that have food and drink in front of them. Guys, if you do too, I'm being empathetic. I may not understand your position, but I'm talking about the power of empathy, so I'm not going to be harsh. But have y'all seen that? Has anyone asked about it? How often do you do it? Who does it? Does it work? How do you know? What do you do when it's done? If it's really good and you're hungry, do you ever help yourself to it? Are there consequences if you do, the spirit that's in there or something? And just by being curious in a non-manipulative way, you begin to engage, what do we hold in common? What do we not hold in common? And the idea is to genuinely connect. And here Paul is describing a positive perception of what it means to be someone who worships a carven image as a representation of your deity. And in doing so, he's able to approach them, and he's able to approach them without abandoning his deep convictions. Again, I experienced this in the village that I was at. One of my good friends in one of the local villages was famous as a carver, and he had carved various dragons and different other parts of things that were used in worship. And I remember him telling me a story about one time in the Cultural Revolution, this really special idol had been hidden out in the woods, and that he and his friend said, we've heard that if you go to this idol and you make a sacrifice, that you can get like almost anything you want. It's sort of a health and wealth thing. You do this, you get that. And so they went to their local health and wealth option. And so they go out in the woods, they find it, and everyone's excited, and he looks at it, and as he's looking, he starts to critique the craftsmanship just spontaneously. And he says, there's got to be a creator that's uncreated. I just can't believe that a created thing that I could actually create could help me. And that was where he was prepared for the gospel. And here, as Paul is talking, he's acknowledging, I can empathize with what it must be like to be like you guys. And I'm doing it in a way that isn't disrespectful, that isn't harsh, that isn't a caricature. It's a real articulation of what it must be to be like you. The fascinating thing with my friend is when he finally heard the gospel and realized that there is a creator above creation and that he's been revealed in Christ, he eagerly accepted Christ and said, this is what I've been waiting for. I just wish someone would have told me earlier. And then he asked me the most amazing question. He said, what does he want? I said, what do you mean? What does he want? What does God want? I'm like trying to think through some sort of Bible spiritual answer. And he's like, no. Like, does he want fruit? Does he want meat? What do I offer him? And I realized that my empathy levels had a long way to go, that I didn't anticipate that would be his natural question. And to begin to explain to him, he wants your gratitude and trust. He wants you, like the song that was sung, to realize that you have an anchor in permanence that goes far beyond anything you can manipulate and control through religion. And that's exactly what Paul does here when he begins to, in his connection, begin with that to correct where he thinks that they're off and wants to challenge them. So he's speaking and he's describing how everyone's got these different ideas of a temple and a God that's been built by human hands and he's served by human hands. And he says, no, you're wrong. He himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. From one man he made all the nations, that they should inhabit the whole earth. And he marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of their lands. Why did God do this? So that they would seek out for him and find him, though he's not far from any one of us, including my friend on the other side of the world. God was already there. I didn't bring God there. We never bring God anywhere. We encounter God where he's already at work, and we join him in what he's doing, and he's not far from anyone, for in him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own poets have said, just like what Don did as we were starting up, free bird. He had a lighter on his phone because we were doing a sound check with the music. And we laughed as Christians and connected with Lynyrd Skynyrd, because it connects to different cultural memories. And here Paul quotes from Epimenides lyrics from their own songs. And he says, I'm listening, I hear you. I'm not repulsed by you. I can take in the things that you're saying, and parts of it I agree with and parts I don't agree with. And sometimes I actually like your music because you're willing to talk about things that my people's music is afraid to talk about, because we eventually want to reject it, but we reject it too soon. So I got to go to you to actually get an artistic expression of it. And here's Paul quoting that. And then he takes the argument from it. Therefore, since we're God's offspring, we shouldn't think that the divine beings like gold or silver, stone, an image made in human design. In the past, he overlooked this ignorance, but now he commands everywhere to repent. This is our final point. You first connect, and then you correct. The idea is, if you're purposeful, you're going to be productive. Look what happens with Paul as we conclude this. He says that this God who's not created by people and controlled by people, in mega churches, country churches, Buddhist temples, or academic settings, we don't create the ideal from our imagination or our controlled rituals. We want to, because we feel insecure. That if we do things for God and we control our understanding and box in how we understand God, then we'll be safe. And God says that fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. What do we fear? We fear things we can't control. Even men who say, I'm not afraid to stand up and fight, if they have a mouse that goes behind the refrigerator and they make fun of their wife, say, oh, come on, it's just a little mouse. And then they get a broom handle and they start to jab back there and the mouse runs out right at him. What's the guy do? Yeah. Woo! And he jumps all over the place. And shut up, you're not funny. Square on, we're fine. We fear what we don't control. The fear of the Lord is a realization you don't control God. Your systematic theology doesn't control God. Your worship schedule doesn't control God. Your efforts to understand him or declare loyalty in your own ways doesn't control God. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. But the end of the story, the telos, the completion, is that perfect, complete, mature love casts out all fear. You can't control him, but you don't need to. You can trust him. And Paul says that you need to make this decision that your old way of looking at God was inadequate. The new way is what you really need to step into. And we know this because our number one enemy is death. And they all heard it, and they're like, wow. And what was the response? A big portion said, that's crazy, and they left. But they heard him. It's one thing to have your proposal in a group meeting shot down because people just don't have the foresight and vision and brilliance that you do. We've all been there, right? We know we're right. They're just not ready for us yet. But it's another thing when people won't even listen to you, and they dismiss you without even heard, what do you think? What do you feel? Where are you approaching this from? Paul is successful because even those who turned him down had to deal with what he was actually saying. If you're good at empathy and you're learning how to communicate effectively, you don't lose your ability to speak powerfully. You increase your ability to speak powerfully in business, in politics, in society, even at Thanksgiving meals, which is coming, even though it doesn't feel like it. You know, I tried wearing autumn, winterish type stuff, but it didn't do anything. I still have my animistic vulnerabilities, but they just don't work. So what happens? Some of them sneered and said, this is ridiculous. Others said, we want to hear more on the subject. The fact that you spoke in a way that connected with me, that challenged me, you now have something that I wouldn't have thought of before. I want to hear an expanded version of what you have to share. That's our goal. Now, I started earlier with the picture of the sniper. When I was in Marine Corps boot camp, one of the things that we did was we had the pugil sticks, those big Q-tips that you like, they're really heavy, and you like beat each other up like it's a pretend rifle. And I was like on a winning streak, and it was awesome, right? So I'm like 18-year-old kid, I'm in boot camp, and just like adrenaline's everywhere, and I'm just winning fight after fight after fight, and I get like all the skin here is just ripped off, right? And so it's like, go to sleep, feeling all heroic and good. In the middle of the night, our drill instructor wakes us up in this booming loud voice, get up. And we have to get up, we have to all move our racks, our bunks out of the way, clear a space, and we're having a secret training session in the middle of the night because the drill instructors are competing with other drill instructors that they want their unit to be the most disciplined, the most tough, the best drilling, and they'll cheat. They'll do anything they can to make you the toughest, meanest, baddest. So we're doing it, and I got my rifle, and it's hurting. It's hurting bad. And I'm trying to like do my discipline and keep my rifle square, and we're doing all this stuff, and one drill instructor's in front yelling at us and trying to exhort us to live up to his standards. And he was doing okay, but there was another drill instructor that knew the power of empathy. And what he did is he saw my finger sticking out to the side, and he snuck up beside me, and he grabbed my finger, and he wadded it into a little ball. At which point, my whole body tightened up in excruciating pain, thinking I'm about to pass out. And he said, "What's the problem, Minnick? Does your finger hurt?" "Sir, yes, sir." "Does it hurt more than this, Minnick?" "Sir, no, sir." "Well, then it doesn't make any sense to have it sticking out, does it, Minnick?" "Sir, no, sir." "All right, keep it straight then, son." Empathy is not about being nice. Empathy is understanding the other person's position so that whatever the message you want to communicate, you can communicate it effectively. But just so I don't leave you on a weird, ugly, militant, human torturing note, because as Christians, that's usually not a great thing, we'll end with this last slide. When Jesus sums up the Old Testament, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. That's what it means to be created and in love with him. I know you're my creator. Everything that I have comes from you, so everything that I have is given back to you. And then what he ends with is love your neighbor as if your neighbor were you. If you were that ethnicity, that religion, that background, that experience, Jesus says, love your neighbor empathetically. This is the full story of the Christian faith. Thank you.